86 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of August 23rd, 1,081 less than a week ago. They occupy 9.4% of hospital beds. 3,493 new cases were reported on August 23rd. There were 27,168 molecular tests reported on August 22nd. That made the positivity rate 16.2%. 11,370 Texans have died as of August 23rd. 104 more deaths reported than the day before, and 1,387 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $42.48, up 14 cents. Now here are coronavirus briefs. The world has topped 23 million coronavirus cases, with the U.S. confirming more than 5.7 million infections. The U.S. coronavirus death toll has surpassed 173,000. U.S. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden said that if he was elected, he would be willing to shut down the country again if scientists recommended it. A Hong Kong man who was initially infected with COVID-19 in April and made a full recovery was reinfected months later after a trip abroad, a new study claims. The researchers say it's the world's first documentation of reinfection and suggests immunity could be only a few months. Two tropical storms threaten to complicate the coronavirus response in the Gulf Coast. Meanwhile, Northern California residents struggle to safely evacuate as wildfires rage. In a hearing with House lawmakers, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy pushed back on criticism that cost-cutting changes to the Postal Service are undercutting delivery of the mail amid growing concerns about mail-in ballots. The company that handles the NFL's testing program said Monday that the league's 77 positive tests over the weekend were most likely false positive results related to an isolated contamination in a New Jersey lab. Zoom users were unable to join meetings Monday as the online teleconferencing company worked to resolve outages nationwide. The service has been widely used since the beginning of the pandemic, as many work from home. A majority of Republicans believe the number of coronavirus-related deaths in the United States, more than 173,000, is acceptable, according to a recent poll. Now we'll read a few short articles. Millions fall back into crisis as stimulus and safety nets vanish. One of the most successful elements of the government's response to the coronavirus recession, protecting people on the margins from falling into poverty, is faltering as the safety net shrinks and federal benefits expire. Major recessions are especially fraught for low-income earners whose finances can veer from tenuous to dire with one missed paycheck. But as the economy cratered this spring, economists and poverty experts were mildly surprised to discover that the torrent of government support that followed, particularly the $600 a week in expanded unemployment benefits and one-time $1,200 stimulus checks, likely lowered the overall poverty rate. In fact, 17 million people would have dropped below the poverty line without the $500 billion in direct intervention for American families, said Zach Perelin, a researcher at Columbia University. Now data show those gains are eroding as federal inaction deprives Americans on the financial margins. New coronavirus cases are decreasing in half of U.S. states. The U.S. has reported more than 5.1 million coronavirus cases since the start of the pandemic, but new cases appear to be declining in many states. At least 25 states are reporting fewer cases in the past week compared to the previous week. Another 14 states have a steady amount of new cases. At least 11 states are reporting an increase in new cases, but no state is seeing more than a 50% jump. It's more important than ever to get a flu shot, say public health experts. Flu season will look different in the U.S. this year as the country grapples with the coronavirus pandemic that has already killed more than 176,000 people. Many Americans are reluctant to visit a doctor's office, and public health officials worry people will shy away from being immunized. Although sometimes incorrectly regarded as just another bad cold, flu also kills tens of thousands of people in the U.S. each year, with the very young, the elderly, and those with underlying conditions the most vulnerable. When coupled with the effects of COVID-19, public health experts say it's more important than ever to get a flu shot. Getting vaccinated for the flu this year is particularly important, World Health Organization officials say. If enough of the U.S. population gets vaccinated, more than the 45% who did last flu season, it could help head off a nightmare scenario in the coming winter of hospitals stuffed with both COVID-19 patients and those suffering from severe effects of influenza. Aside from the potential burden on hospitals, there's the possibility people could get both viruses, and no one knows what happens if you get influenza and COVID simultaneously, because it's never happened before. Dr. Rachel Levine, Pennsylvania's Secretary of Health, told reporters last week. Now we'll go to the first of our pre-recorded reports. From the Texas Standard, the COVID-19 vaccine, inside America's race for an answer.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Several COVID vaccines are in human trials right now, but in San Antonio, researchers have discovered an animal that will allow scientists to broaden their search for vaccines and treatments for the disease that has shut down the world. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie tells us about it.
Someone opens a cage. Inside, a group of hungry mice. It's time for a snack. Mice have a key role in the search for a COVID vaccine, but Texas Biomedical Research Institute vaccine scientist Dr. Joanne Turner says these are not your ordinary mice.
So the mice that we're using to test for COVID are regular mice that have been genetically engineered to have the expression of a human receptor.
Genetically modified mice.
So normal lab mouse will not get sick from SARS-CoV-2. But as soon as you have a mouse that expresses the human ACE2 protein, they get incredibly sick. They have virus everywhere and a lot of really bad symptoms, which replicates really sick humans.
Turner is one of the leaders of the team that discovered these transgenic mice are a good animal model for testing treatments and vaccines for this coronavirus. Texas Biomed's Dr. Luis Martinez-Sobrido is another leader on the project.
Similar to other viruses, what it caused the people to die from infection is not the virus itself, is the, let's say, the immune reaction that you get to the viral infection from your own organism.
He explains that, like some humans, these mice experience cytokine storms in response to the COVID virus. That's an uncontrolled immune system response to a pathogen it doesn't recognize.
And that's what we found previously, for instance, with the 1918 influenza that killed 50 million people worldwide. It was not a different virus than any other influenza. It was just that the ability of causing this uncontrolled cytokine storm was what it makes the symptoms and the lethality of the virus so high.
Now that the Biomed team has figured out these mice get sick with COVID in much the same way humans do, they can get to work. But if there are several COVID vaccines already being tested in humans in the United States, why do you need an animal model at all?
Well, because the idea of going and testing vaccines directly in human without previous safety and efficacy studies in an animal model is completely unprecedented. It never happened before. It's the first time that happened. And quite understandable based on, you know, the pandemic of the virus.
Martinez Sobrido says that means they had to be very careful with these first vaccine candidates.
I mean, the vaccines that they move to human clinical trials, they have a very strong safety profile. And we knew that they are vaccines that they are not going to cause any side effect on humans. So they were pretty safe.
The same is true of potential COVID treatments they've been using in human trials, like remdesivir and dexamethasone. They've already been tested in humans and have a known safety profile. Now, though, thanks to our little mice friends, researchers can try a lot more options.
So having an animal model where we can test multiple vaccines or we can test multiple drugs, I think that is going to be a breakthrough.
A breakthrough that may eventually shine a light of hope all over the world. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
You can learn more about the race for a COVID vaccine in this week's episode of Texas Public Radio's Petri Dish podcast. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Our next segment runs 10 minutes. This is from NPR, and it's a coronavirus news roundup. A COVID-19 therapy makes headlines.
The Trump administration has cleared the way for convalescent plasma to be used to treat more COVID-19 patients. We are talking about using blood plasma from other people, people who've recovered from a coronavirus infection. Thousands of patients have already been treated this way, but the FDA's emergency use authorization increases access. And let's begin our discussion of this with NPR's Allison Aubrey, who's here this morning. Hi, Allison.
Good morning, David.
Can you just give us the basics here? What exactly is convalescent plasma, and has it been effective so far?
Sure. Convalescent plasma is based on the idea that antibodies from people who have recovered from COVID-19 can help protect people who are currently sick with the virus. So plasma is taken from recovered people and transfused into patients who are hospitalized battling the virus. Now, all of the experts I've spoken to say this is not a magic bullet. It's one more therapy that could be helpful. Now, there's been concern that there's not enough evidence to show how effective it is. There are more studies underway now, and the thinking among administration officials seems to be this. Look, it's safe. It looks promising, especially if people are treated early. Let hospitals keep using it. It was used at Mount Sinai in New York during the early months of the pandemic and at Houston Methodist. Doctors have more tools in their toolkit now, I'd say. There's remdesivir, steroids. So plasma could be thought of as sort of one more tool to try.
Well, Allison, stay with us if you can. I want to come back to you.
Sure.
For the moment, I want to turn to one expert who's on the line with us. She's also someone who's been closely involved in decisions about whether to approve medical treatments. Dr. Margaret Hamburg was the commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration for 6 years during the Obama administration. Dr. Hamburg, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So as Allison described it, it sounds like this could be one more tool in the toolkit. Let's start with the therapy itself. I mean, how much potential, how much promise do you see here in terms of saving lives?
Well, it has promise. We know that convalescent plasma has been used to treat patients for decades, really. But what we don't know is how it works in this case. Is it truly effective? When in the course of disease might it be most effective, and for which patients? And that's very important information when we want to provide the best care to patients. And in fact, the data collected so far really does not ask and answer that set of critical questions, because it hasn't been done. The right studies that are controlled haven't been done as of yet.
Yeah, I mean, you've actually called the FDA's decision here disturbing. Why are you so worried about it?
Well, you know, first of all, it did not seem necessary at this time, in that there really is access to convalescent plasma that's quite widespread under an existing expanded access program. More than 66,000 people have received it. What's desperately needed now, in my view, is to really do the right study so that we can ask and answer the questions about, does it really work for whom and when in the course of disease? We really can best serve patients with that information. But what also worries me is the way that all of this unfolded, the way it was framed, you know, the increasing politicization of the FDA process. And this is a critical time for the public to have confidence in the FDA that it is making evidence-based, science-driven decisions about things that really matter for health.
I mean, you could look at this in a bunch of different ways. I mean, some have noted this decision comes as the Republican convention is just starting, which some have said they might think there could be politics involved. But I also wonder, I mean, this is a desperate moment, right? We're in a pandemic. We have like 1,000 Americans dying on some days. Isn't the bar lower to approve something like this and get it approved as quickly as possible?
Well, what happened with the emergency use authorization, first of all, is not an approval. It is something that in a public health crisis like the one we're experiencing enables FDA to put out a product in a more urgent way, looking at all of the available data and making the decision about whether the apparent benefits outweigh risks. And, you know, in that context, offering an EUA for this product, I think, you know, can be supported. The larger question, though, is that even in a public health crisis like COVID-19, we really want to be able to do what's best for patients and individuals at risk. And that means actually studying the issues to know what works so that we can offer patients the best therapies and treatments possible. And right now with convalescent plasma, we actually don't know what the answer is. It probably has some marginal benefit. It's probably not much. But in order for doctors and patients to make the best decisions about care, we need more information. And I hope this will not interfere with the ability to do some ongoing clinical studies to get those answers.
I want to ask you one related question about vaccines. Obviously, we're all waiting for that moment. The Financial Times is reporting that the Trump administration might be thinking about fast-tracking an experimental coronavirus vaccine from the UK. What do you think of that?
Well, we are moving very, very swiftly in trying to develop a whole set of vaccines to potentially protect against coronavirus infection. I think we need to move forward as swiftly as we can, do everything we can to make vaccines that work and are safe available to people. I can't comment on that specific issue, but I do think that we need to move as effectively and efficiently as possible, but without cutting corners when it comes to making sure that we know whether the vaccine actually works and whether it's safe to give to the people who need it.
Former FDA Commissioner Dr. Margaret Hamburg, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And NPR's Allison Aubrey is still here. Allison, I wonder if we could broaden out the conversation a little bit and look at this pandemic.
Sure.
As a whole, we've got new cases declining in the U.S. That sounds good, but it's still circulating widely. A lot of questions now about keeping students safe if schools decide to reopen in person. So, like, where are we here?
Sure. I mean, big picture, as you say, new cases are declining over the last week or so. There's been about 44,000 new cases per day, so still a lot, but that's a significant decline compared to a month ago. There are still a lot of people dying, as we've been saying, about 1,000 deaths a day. That's about 40 people every hour. Hospitalizations have begun to decline, so that's encouraging. But given that the virus is still circulating widely, it's a reminder to stay vigilant since we don't yet have a vaccine or a cure-all.
I mean, as we just heard Dr. Hamper talking about, like, I mean, everyone wants to get a vaccine, I mean,
sure,
out there as quickly as possible, but there are concerns about doing it safely. The president is saying that he's not happy with the pace of vaccine research. Can you talk about what we're hearing from him?
Sure. I mean, over the weekend, the president tweeted a theory that doesn't seem to match the facts. He said the FDA is making it difficult for drug companies to get people into vaccine trials, suggesting that there were political motivations at the agency to slow the process and delay until after the election. But, you know, former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb said on CBS, this just does not fit with reality. He says the agency is guided by science, by its public health mission, and he says the process to test a vaccine is moving ahead very quickly.
The vaccine trials have enrolled very fast. Moderna and Pfizer, the two U.S. manufacturers who are the furthest ahead, enrolled 25,000 patients into those trials in the 4 weeks that those trials have been stood up, and they've really only been enrolling in earnest for 3 weeks. That's extraordinary. So to say that these products aren't moving at really historic pace, I think is wrong.
And remember, Gottlieb led the FDA early in the Trump administration. So, you know, many public health experts just wince at the idea of politics getting in the way or the suggestion that the administration could fast track the process.
Allison, let me ask you about something else. We have these moments when, you know, health officials are saying this is how you avoid spreading the virus. For example, avoid large crowds. And then We see these images on the news and on social media of people in large crowds, and we're seeing it coming from college campuses right now.
Sure.
These parties with students in big groups, no masks. How worrisome is this?
Yes, lots of images on social media. You know, campuses are cracking down on parties and big gatherings. Schools know that if they get it wrong in these first few days or weeks, it's going to be hard, almost impossible, to prevent or control outbreaks. So we've seen this play out at Chapel Hill, at Notre Dame, where in-person classes were suspended. And then when you think about the kindergarten to high schoolers, you know, the evidence is clear, David, that children get the virus. They can spread the virus, especially older kids. So it's important to protect at-risk teachers and students. The CDC director, Robert Redfield, has said it is possible to open safely if there are precautions in place. He points to evidence from Rhode Island, where he says the state successfully opened daycare centers. Now, the daycares did identify infected people, but they quarantined them, and that helped prevent spread to the community. Now, in order to do this effectively, you have to identify people who are infected quickly. You need testing, preferably rapid testing, to get this done.
NPR's Allison Aubrey for us this morning. Allison, thank you, as always.
Thank you, David.
Now here's a feature about how, even after recovery, some people still have symptoms.
Dr. Margo Gage is among the roughly 2 million Americans who have recovered from a coronavirus infection. But Dr. Gage, like tens of thousands of others, still continues to suffer from confounding and at times painful symptoms. She's also a social epidemiologist and a professor at Lamar University and joins us now from Beaumont, Texas. Dr. Gage, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
How are you feeling today?
Tired.
Yeah. And that's been the case for a few months.
Yes. Almost going into my 6 month.
Can you help us to understand how you've been, how you feel now, what these last 6 months have been like for you?
They've been health-wise the worst in my life that I've ever experienced. I've been in and out of the hospital. I see specialists regularly, a lot of being poked and prodded and tests. It's been a challenge.
Have you experienced symptoms that aren't on the CDC's list or totally surprised you or something that you just weren't expecting?
Yes. The CDC list does not contain all the symptoms that people suffering with COVID long-term can have. A lot of COVID long haulers are reporting that their nails are growing really long, but our hair is falling out. Other symptoms, for example, I have ringing in my ears that I never had before. That's not on their list. Vision issues. Oh, and another symptom that I forgot about, I'm thinking that's not on that list, is I have like really weird skin problems going on, like weird patches of like, it's like a rash. And another symptom is going out into the sun for me is really debilitating. It's like I'm allergic to the sun almost.
And none of these symptoms are on the CDC guidelines?
No. And that was the problem in the beginning with me, for why it was so hard for me to get my COVID diagnosis in the beginning, is because I didn't have a fever or a persistent cough.
Yeah.
And then later the list expanded. So as we can see, it's ever changing their list, but they need to hurry it up.
You did not have a fever before?
Ever. I never had a fever. But something what I do have is like the only thing I can describe it as is like having hot flashes, but I'm not in like the hot flash age group whatsoever. So I have to keep my house really cold because my body is feeling hot, even though I don't have an elevated temperature.
And yet, I guess technically on somebody's chart, they would count you as a success story because you're still with us, right? Well, and so we're glad.
Probably, yes. My doctors are really happy that my organs were strong enough to keep me alive and going strong.
Yeah. Are you able to work?
I'm not able to work in the same capacity as what I used to. I am having memory problems, brain fog, and too much energy can leave me on bed rest.
I gather your work includes the study of viruses. What should we learn from people like you at the moment in cases like yours?
Well, what we can look at is past history. And we know that with MERS and with SARS and with viruses in general, people can experience post-viral syndrome with symptoms that manifest as chronic fatigue syndrome. So it's kind of to be expected that some people would have contacted what I'm contacting with having with COVID complications.
I wonder if you look at all the official statistics in a different way, given what you've been through. You're in a different category, aren't you?
Yes, and I think that scientists need to start looking at us as well, because there's a huge proportion of people, this hidden population.
And of course, we note you live in Beaumont, Texas. Texas has obviously been a hot spot. I wonder if you have any words for your fellow Texans you think they ought to hear right now.
Well, take precautions, because it's not just the flu. And you don't have to be a sick person, because I was a healthy person with no preconditions.
Dr. Margot Gage is a professor of epidemiology at Lamar University in Beaumont, Texas. Thank you so much. Good luck. Good health to you.
Thank you for having me.
And now a look at the frontline workers. As pandemic persists, healthcare heroes beginning to crack under the strain.
For the last 5 months, we've called healthcare workers heroes. Many have seemed unflappable in the face of COVID, but some are beginning to feel the strain, especially Latino physicians who are treating Latino communities hit disproportionately hard by the pandemic. Leslie McClurg from member station KQED has the story of two Los Angeles doctors.
Orange County is a hotspot in California. The emergency department where Victor Cisneros works is often overwhelmed with COVID cases.
The waiting room is just, you know, blowing out of the seams. Sometimes there's people waiting for hours just because there's not enough beds in the hospital. There's not enough providers.
Most of the patients waiting for care are Latino. The group has been three times as likely to get the virus compared to whites in the U.S. Public health experts credit that to essential jobs, multi-generational homes, and higher rates of comorbidities like diabetes. Cisneros says most of his patients come from families like his.
I grew up very underserved. I come from a very humble family, and I'm the first physician, first person to graduate, like, college.
He's originally from Mexico, but now much of his family lives in L.A., though social distancing has made it hard to feel close.
We're very lovey-dovey, hugging, kissing the cheek is a normal thing when you say goodbye or say hi, you know, and it's like, it was hard.
Made even harder because he lives alone.
You just feel trapped, right? Because you're in the ER for 10 hours, which are intense, exhausting. It smells. People are vomiting. There's blood.
So he needs time off to recharge.
And now all the things that give you satisfaction away from work, family, loved ones, working out, going to dinner, are not there. And now you're like, I'm in a couch in front of a screen by myself.
He's scared he might give the virus to friends or family.
I don't know how sustainable this can be. I know for a fact, maybe physicians that are already burnt out, this is probably the tipping edge for them.
You know, doctors aren't the biggest help seekers. Suffering is kind of part of the profession to some degree, but people shouldn't be suffering.
That's Deborah Marin. She's a psychiatrist in New York City. She directs a new program for the Mount Sinai Health System designed to address issues like depression, anxiety, or post-traumatic stress disorder, all of which are up right now in healthcare workers.
The idea is to shore up people's resilience and be supportive of them. They need to feel like they're not in this alone.
It's a model for other hospitals. There's a hotline, a wellness app, and workshops designed to help connect nurses and doctors who are toasted, people like Denora Chinchilla.
All I saw was COVID, COVID, COVID. I felt like every day was on repeat.
Chinchilla is a pulmonologist in Los Angeles County. It's the hardest hit area of California, with more than 5,000 deaths. For months, most of her patients have been connected to a ventilator to breathe. The majority are older, overweight, diabetic, and Latino.
Seeing how disproportionately COVID has affected the Latino population and being able to be that person for them now is what I always wanted.
As a child growing up in East LA, Chinchilla dreamed of treating low-income families like hers.
But that comes with a big burden. It was just so emotional. I can't say that I didn't cry often.
And the heartache doesn't end at work. When Chinchilla gets home, her two young children run towards her, but she has to run in the opposite direction.
How sad is that? Not being able to hug your child when she's so happy that you're home because you've been gone for 14 hours.
Chinchilla doesn't embrace her kids until she scrubs herself raw in a hot shower. She recently took time off to reconnect with them, but still felt the tug of the hospital.
At the same time, I feel that duty of, like, this is my specialty. This is what I signed up for. I have to be there.
But that conviction does wane when she sees the public ignore simple protocols like wearing a mask.
If you guys just would step into the ICU for 5 minutes and just see what I see and experience what I experience, I just have no doubt that people would be more mindful.
She says it's hard to keep giving if it doesn't feel like we're all in this together. For NPR News, I'm Leslie McClurg.
Now here's a story that tries to explain why coronavirus super spreading events happen.
Researchers now think the main way the coronavirus spreads is through group scenarios. The indoor party, the business conference, a cruise ship. This is not typically how a virus like the flu spreads, but it seems to be a distinguishing trait of the coronavirus. NPR's Ping Huang explains why.
A person with a high viral load walks into a bar. And if that bar was in Hong Kong's Lan Kwai Fong nightlife district this spring, that person may have triggered one of the biggest coronavirus clusters in the city. The virus spread between 106 bargoers, bar workers, and musicians in that district over a period of 2 weeks in March.
And when these clusters get very big, then you sort of then call it super spreading.
Gabriel Leung is Dean of Medicine at the University of Hong Kong and co-author on a forthcoming paper that looks at super spreading events in Hong Kong. He says that bar district had all the high-risk factors that make it easy for the coronavirus to spread.
Any setting that is an enclosed space, that is poorly ventilated, that is crowded, and that has unprotected behavior, that would tend to create a lot of clusters.
Maria Van Kerkhove, a top scientist with the World Health Organization, says this pattern of spread is a hallmark of the coronavirus.
There's some really good estimates out there that suggest that between 10 and 20% of cases are responsible for about 80% of transmission events.
This pattern, where one person or one event results in a lot of cases, was also seen with the original SARS virus, which swept through Asia in 2003. Jamie Lloyd-Smith at UCLA studies how diseases spread. He's looked at a wide range of past outbreaks, from measles to smallpox to pneumonic plague, and in all cases, he says, there are some clusters of transmission. But for the coronavirus and its cousin virus SARS-1, clusters seem to be a major driver.
Both SARS-1 and SARS-2 are at the relatively super spready extreme.
One difference between these viruses is that this coronavirus is more of a party-crashing virus. It spreads pretty efficiently from people who don't know they're sick. Leung at the University of Hong Kong says that's different from flu or even the first SARS coronavirus.
40% of transmission will have taken place before the index patient even shows symptoms.
Research is showing that people may actually be most contagious in the day or two before they start feeling sick, which is why we're seeing so many super spreading events in bars and nightclubs and restaurants and not just in hospitals. It's hitching rides from one person's respiratory tract to another's, all while everyone is feeling totally fine. Seema Lakdawala, a flu researcher at the University of Pittsburgh, says that some people may also naturally spread the virus more than others. It may come down to differences in biology, like how much virus a person sheds or even how it comes out. One theory at the moment, she says,
it could be that people who have really sticky mucus are more likely to be super spreaders.
Scientists are working hard to untangle the details of why super spreading events are happening, but the bones of it are clear. When a person with a high viral load walks into a bar, be careful. Ping Huang, NPR News.
As the national conventions continue, we are reminded that Election Day is not too far off in the future. Here's an NPR story about how election officials are working to ease fears over voting in a pandemic.
Across the country, people have been complaining that their mail is coming late or not at all, and that has voters, campaigns, and election officials worried. But the stakes feel particularly high in battleground states like Pennsylvania, and election officials are trying to balance mail delivery problems and fears from voters. Lucy Perkins of member station WESA in Pittsburgh reports.
What happened to voter Patricia DiMarco is what everyone is trying to avoid in November.
I was horrified. I was really horrified. I was shocked, and I was like, there's no way I'm not going to vote.
Patricia's 74 and lives outside Pittsburgh. She's particularly vulnerable to COVID, so she decided to vote by mail in the June primary. She got her ballot, filled it out, and sent it back. But when she went online to check if it was received, nothing came up. So on election day, she went to her polling place.
I did. I wore a surgical type of mask, and then I had a scarf over my face as well.
After waiting in a long line, poll workers had her fill out a provisional ballot in case her other one got lost. There are barcodes on ballots to ensure that you can't vote twice. Still, she was alarmed. She'd never missed an election before and had no intention of starting in 2020.
People take voting seriously in this town, and I don't like to see impediments cast against people who are trying to vote and exercise their civic responsibility.
It's still unclear what happened to Patricia's original ballot, but what's becoming very obvious is that the state's vote-by-mail deadline may not work this year. Right now, voters can request a ballot up until 7 days before the election, but the Postal Service says it needs a week to deliver that ballot and another week to return it to the election office. So officials are trying to do two things at once: change the deadlines and calm people's fears. Secretary of State Kathy Buchvar recently addressed those concerns.
The department and county election offices are working day and night to make sure that every eligible Pennsylvanian's vote is counted in November, no matter whether they vote by mail or they vote in person.
She's asked the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to extend the deadline for mail-in ballots to be received by 3 days until the Friday after the election. The state's also going to cover postage and is working with counties to start mailing out ballots earlier in September. Another solution, drop boxes. Here's Vic Volchek with the Pennsylvania ACLU.
People can drop off their ballots. They will be picked up and taken by the Department of Elections and counted. You don't have to worry about whether your ballot is going to be delivered in time by the U.S. Postal Service.
But the Trump campaign is suing every elections department in the state over the practice, alleging the possibility of voter fraud. The campaign didn't make anyone available for an interview, but a senior campaign official said that, quote, President Trump will continue fighting for a free, fair, transparent election so that every valid ballot counts and counts once. Volchek represents several voting rights groups in the lawsuit.
While the Trump campaign raises the specter of fraud, they have not pointed to a single instance of that kind of fraud happening. On the other hand, you have people who are legitimately being disenfranchised because the mail-in ballot system doesn't work well enough.
Given that it's already August, experts say drop boxes are the best bet states have to alleviate fears. Matt Weil is director of the Elections Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center.
Of the things that you could do to make vote-by-mail work, they are one of the best options left. Drop boxes tend to not be very expensive and can be rolled out on a pretty quick timeline.
With ballots getting mailed out next month, the Pennsylvania Attorney General wants the state Supreme Court to take up these issues as soon as possible. For NPR News, I'm Lucy Perkins in Pittsburgh.
Here's an interesting short report about navigating sports action amid a global pandemic.
Pandemic or no pandemic, European soccer goes on and successfully crowned its latest club champion over the weekend.
Chance for the far post, and the header is in by Kingsley Coman. Breakthrough for Bayern Munich, and the goal scorer is a Parisian.
Bayern Kingsley Munich Coman beat Paris Saint-Germain 1-0 in the Champions League final. The tournament is played each year between Europe's top club teams. Stadium fans, though, were absent for Sunday's global event. Cheers, boos, they were all piped into the broadcast. CBS Sports broadcaster Clive Tiltsley described the scene this way.
In any other year, the scale of the event would present a unique test of the temperament of those not familiar with such occasions. I guess the eerie, empty stadium is a less intimidating, less nerve-wracking setting for this, the ultimate game.
Now, how do you do all this safely? Well, the organization that oversees the Champions League, the Union of European Football Associations, issued a 31-page set of safety guidelines. It included this about a time-honored tradition after the game. Players are recommended to refrain from swapping their shirts.
McKinnon in the high slot. Shoot! He scores! The Avalanche come right back a minute, 4 seconds. After the Tyler Seguin goal, we are tied at one.
As we're hearing there, professional sports go on in the U.S. as well, sort of. Hockey's in the middle of playoffs, like the game there between the Colorado Avalanche and the Dallas Stars. Baseball has been back as well with no fans for a month now. Some games have been postponed because of positive coronavirus cases. It is playoff time in the NBA, with players keeping inside a bubble in Florida to avoid exposure.
Doncic pulls up, three-pointer. Bang! Bang! It's good! Doncic wins the game at the buzzer!
The NFL is set to begin games next month. Daily COVID-19 testing turned up some positives for teams over the weekend. The NFL is investigating several false positive results from a New Jersey lab. Avery Williams, a linebacker for the New York Jets, told ESPN this is all kind of, quote, crazy, but he says, I just hope we can stay as clean as possible.
Now back focusing on Texas. Here's an article about marching through the pandemic. Lubbock students return to band camp.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Marching band is an important part of the high school experience for many Texas students, but it's an activity that involves a lot of breathing and saliva, which can be transmitters of the coronavirus, as we've heard. Still, the show goes on at many schools as they get back in session. Sarah Self-Walbrick from Texas Tech Public Media takes us to band camp at Lubbock High School.
5, 6.
It's day 4 of summer marching band practice at Lubbock High School. Students in shorts and t-shirts take measured steps in a parking lot next to the school under an unforgiving noontime sun. 16-year-old saxophone player Tristan Wright isn't rehearsing today.
I just want to help be able to give people that one constant, you know, that one constant being band and having this community of people.
After 6 years of playing, Wright is a band leader and now mentors the younger members. 130 students are at band camp this year, a lot of them incoming freshmen.
Between the online and in-person, it's going to look a bit different than, you know, everybody's in the band hall playing their instruments.
Wright says he'll take academic classes online in the fall, but will attend marching band in person. The school district is the only public one in the city, allowing students to do virtual classes, but participate in certain face-to-face activities.
I want instant sound on the downbeat. You do not have to hesitate. You know what the exercise is.
Walk the band director, Melanie Settle, walks through the rows of students, spaced 6 feet apart, and gives directions through a headset microphone and a face mask.
Quality.
Everyone wears a mask. It's required by the Lubbock Independent School District. Brass and woodwind musicians pull their masks below their chins when it's time to play. After a surge of COVID cases in June, Lubbock has averaged a steady 90 new cases a day since July 1st. State guidelines allowed for summer marching band practices to start in August. Not every Texas district returned, but Lubbock ISD chose to. The district's fine arts director, Andrew Babcock, says based on research he's seen, marching band isn't much riskier than sitting in a math class. But he is following state guidelines, and they've come up with their own precautions. Practice is mostly outside and in smaller than usual groups.
We are doing mandated temperature checks for every student as they get out of their vehicle. So before they can even get onto the practice lot, we're doing all of the pre-symptom checks on every student.
Thank you. This is a new exercise. We've never done it before.
Settle says when the state gave the green light for school districts to have summer band practice, her students were excited.
They're just ready to be back and be with their friends and get back into their routines and feel normal again.
She says the students are taking the safety measures seriously so they can continue with the season, which will include the usual halftime performances at football games and band competitions.
So to have everybody back in the same space and remember that we're all in the same, you know, we're all on the same journey, we're all doing the same thing. Man, that culture it's priceless in person.
Band leader Tristan Wright says band makes school worthwhile for him. After graduation, he says he may pursue music education.
I've always just had, you know, a drive to be here for band. You know, the core classes, you know, well, I'll go over to those, but it's really band that keeps me interested and invested in school. It's what gets me up, and that's something that's just stayed with me.
Wright isn't the only student who feels that way about his extracurricular passion. Babcock, the district's fine arts director, says the majority of Lubbock ISD kids participate in the arts, and the social and emotional effects of participating in person balance the risk of gathering together during the pandemic.
This little window into a piece of normal that's done differently but still somewhat normal is filling a void that is really hard to quantify.
Can you take the quality of that sound and put it on the move? 16 to 5. Point to where you will be in 16 steps.
About a week after band camp started, at the beginning of this month, the school district confirmed one person with the Lubbock High band tested positive for COVID-19. The district superintendent and the principal wrote a statement to parents saying the exposure was low risk. The message from school leaders states, practice continues. In Lubbock, I'm Sarah Self-Walbrick.
And now here is our semi-regular feature from the Texas Standard, Ask a Doctor. A UT Health San Antonio physician answers listeners' questions about their health during the coronavirus pandemic.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. As we've done most weeks during the pandemic, it's time once more to turn to your questions about COVID-19. We've been inviting listeners to send in questions about the coronavirus or what to do about it, and we've been getting some answers from Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine and associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
I'm glad to be back, David.
This question is from an anonymous listener who sent this to us through texasstandard.com/coronavirus. This person asks, Taiwan's population is over 23 million and there have only been 7 COVID-related deaths there. Texas's population is over 29 million, but over 10,000 people have died from the virus here. What can we learn from Taiwan?
Taiwan did it all right. Of course, Taiwan sits on an island, which is considerably different than a lot of countries. They knew about MERS and previous SARS infections because they were affected by them, so they were very much prepared both to restrict travel into Taiwan and also to do some incredible efforts to minimize the transmission of COVID-19, including quarantining people pretty much whether they wanted to or not as soon as they were identified. Mm-hmm. That was something that the people of Taiwan, just like Korea and some other places, were willing to accept and trade that for some privacy and civil rights kinds of restrictions.
Dr. Campbell, here's a practical question for you. Just how safe is it to go to the dentist right now? And would you go to yours?
I have been to mine. I've had two dental hygiene appointments, and it was very, very impressive. I go to the dental school at UT in their practice. The dental hygienists are no longer using things like the water syringes, which can generate an aerosol. Mm. And people that have to have cavities or other kinds of procedures done will actually be tested ahead of time and results come back as to whether they're COVID positive or not. So they're going to do everything they can to minimize the risk by common sense things, such as checking temperatures, for instance, on everyone that comes in.
Sounds like you're pretty comfortable with the process that dentists are putting in place.
I'm very comfortable with the academic setting that I went to, and I'm hoping that most dentists will follow that. It's part of the website, and so I'm hoping everybody else will emulate that good practice.
Well, now this question comes to us from listener Mellon West. Mellon asks, I'm trying to create a visual image of virus spread in the air. How does it move? How long does it stay airborne? Does it drift like cigarette smoke, or is it more like an aerosol?
That is a wonderful question, and there is a difference between the particles that are sneezed or coughed out, which are droplets, large droplets, and usually don't go beyond the 6-foot perimeter we've talked about. And then the other kinds of particles are micro drops, what would be called aerosols, similar to what you might get when you're using an asthma inhaler, for instance, and they can stay in the air much longer. The question, of course, is going to be how infectious is that kind of an aerosol? We're not certain. Experimentation hasn't been complete in that area. But there's no question that good ventilation, filtration of air, circulation of air, and even use of fans could make a big difference in terms of the aerosols, which do hang around longer and go farther than 6 feet.
You know, I'm wondering, Doctor, should any of that inform decision-making when it comes to what spaces one might want to or not want to hang around in?
Outside is always better than inside, which would be a real good rule of thumb. There appears to be some benefit from what airlines are doing right now, which is circulation of air, very much like we do in hospitals when people are highly infectious. For the most part, the best thing to do is to continue to follow those social distancing rules, which is the 6 foot distance, the masking, and the hand washing, and then, of course, not spend prolonged periods of time indoors with people who do not do that.
Words to live by, especially right now. We've been talking with Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine at the Long School at UT Health San Antonio. We've been having him join us regularly over the course of the coronavirus pandemic to answer your questions. Now, if you have something you'd like to ask, look for us on Twitter, Facebook, or go over to texasstandard.org/coronavirus, and you'll find a form there where you can submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for joining us again. We appreciate it.
I appreciate helping out.
And finally today, we're going to leave you with an article that was published in the Midland Reporter-Telegram. Boy sells cups of lemonade to buy diapers for single moms. Cartier Carey is spending his summer the way many American children do, behind a lemonade stand. The 11-year-old boy sells the summertime staple from his front lawn in Hampton, Virginia, next to a paper sign that reads, "Raising Money for Single Mothers." Cartier, a rising sixth grader, told his parents in July that he wants to help single mothers struggling financially during the coronavirus pandemic. Although Cartier's parents are together and active in his life, a lot of his friends have single moms, said Cartier's mother, Brittany Stewart, 30. Through them, he knows how hard it can be. Cartier explained, "It's just one of them, and they're doing everything on their own." With most schools and summer camps shuttered since March, pandemic parenting is a big load to carry alone. But perhaps the biggest burden of the pandemic for single parents is the anxiety of contracting the coronavirus and what it would mean for their children who depend on them exclusively. The United States has the world's highest rate of single-parent households. 1 in 4 children live with only one parent. In 80% of those cases, women are the sole caregiver. Through his peers, Cartier has witnessed the unique set of challenges single parents face, particularly during the pandemic. "One of Cartier's closest friends has a single mom," said Stewart, adding that the friend is often at their house while his mother is at work. Cartier started the lemonade stand with the support of his parents, 4 younger siblings, and a number of neighborhood children. All proceeds go directly toward purchasing diapers, baby wipes, and other supplies for local single mothers in need. Cartier and his friends have been stationed on his front lawn since mid-July, selling lemonade for $1, chips for 50 cents, and candy for 25 cents, most days of the week. Next to the snack station is a separate table packed with diapers and wipes for parents to come collect. "We didn't expect it would take off so quickly," said Stewart. "We raised $3,000 in the first 3 days." The family lives near a busy intersection, so passing motorists frequently visit the lemonade stand, and neighbors stop by regularly, Stewart said. "A lot of the time, people see the sign and want to donate," she said. "Many will ask to buy lemonade for $1, but they'll usually leave $20. So far, the lemonade stand has yielded $7,500, enough to purchase approximately 27,500 diapers. Every few days, Cartier and Stewart go to Walmart to buy supplies, which they've distributed to local shelters, churches, and directly to women who have heard about the initiative and shown up. Shania Green, an 18-year-old single mother with a 7-month-old baby, works at a McDonald's restaurant and struggles to pay for diapers. She has collected supplies from Cartier twice in the past month. It has been really helpful because I truly can't afford all of this on my own, Green said. As many as 25 single mothers have shown up daily over the past few weeks, Stewart estimated, including one woman whose gratitude was captured in a video. You are helping so many people, you have no idea, said the woman, through tears. You're an amazing young man, and you're going to go far. People have heard about Cartier's lemonade stand through word of mouth and social media, Stewart said, adding that local news attention has raised awareness too. Cartier's lemonade stand is not his first effort to help people in need. In February, Cartier and his mother created care packages to distribute to the homeless, which included sanitizer, hand warmers, soap, tissues, snacks, water, and other supplies. Cartier has always been involved in the community, said his father, Anthony Carey, 32. He's always looking to help other people. A year ago, Cartier launched his own nonprofit organization called Kids for Change 757, which, through initiatives like the care packages and lemonade stand, encourages children to get involved and support communities in need. It is funded by donations. Other children in the neighborhood have followed Cartier's lead, putting their free time toward helping to run the lemonade stand and organize supplies. It fills my heart up to help these people, said Jasmine Ballard, 19, who lives in Cartier's neighborhood and has been helping him since July. They cry when they hug us, and it feels so good to know that we can help them and their families. Beyond providing parents with critical supplies, Cartier said he hopes his initiative will alert the community about the struggles single mothers face during the pandemic. I really want to raise awareness, said Cartier, who is attending school virtually this fall and will continue raising money for single mothers and other Virginia residents in need. I want to spend all my free time doing this, he said. And that is your coronavirus update for this Monday, August 24th, 2020. We'll be bringing you USA Today coming up next with national news. At 3 o'clock, of course, it's your local news. Here are some of the articles we'll be reading from the past few days of both of our local newspapers. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, MISD seeks Riddick dismissal. Riddick era appears to be in jeopardy. MISD board made the right decision. Midland unemployment steady at 9.4%. U.S. rig count up by 10. A&M reports record set for home sales and total volume. Committee co-chair says Robert E. Lee doesn't represent school. From the Odessa American, nonprofits work for Permian Basin gives. Marshall takes on Dowling Elementary. Odessa police investigating car pedestrian fatality. Odessa strong 1 year later. Odessa remembers and honors victims. Why did this happen to Rudy? Those are some of the articles we'll be reading coming up at 3 o'clock this afternoon, and then the Wall Street Journal will have more news for it. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 88 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 70s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, it's Monday, August 24th, 2020. And the headline story today is GOP's turn to make case for Trump win. 4-day convention likely will aim to lift nation's spirits. And then there's a photo accompanying this with a large welcome, a red, white, and blue sign with an elephant and stars like our flag. And a number of men in suits are standing in front of a convention center, most of them with masks on. High Stakes to Refocus Narrative. This is by John Fritz and Courtney Sabramian out of Washington, D.C. Now it's Donald Trump's turn, relegated to spectator status last week as Democrats put on the first of its kind virtual convention. The president has signaled a desire for an upbeat and mostly live four-day performance befitting a former reality TV star with a flair for the dramatic. Down in battleground polls amid a devastating pandemic and a weak economy, the Republican National Convention gives Trump a nick of time opportunity to reset his campaign, define how he would use a